This is Photo Geek Weekly, episode 18, recorded on March 16th, 2018. This is the podcast that dives kind of behind the headlines, the geeky stories, the technology, the science that the photographic industry can put out on a weekly basis. And this week, I am delighted to be joined by Darlene Hildebrandt, who is a longtime colleague and is a voice of reason, I think. I've always valued your opinions and looking forward to seeing what opinions you have here today, Darlene. Thanks so much for being on.
Oh, thanks, Don. I'm always good for sharing an opinion. I have many of them.
Good. Well, we'll get as many of those from you as possible on these kind of geeky topics, which it's kind of fun to have you on the program, which, by the way, you're the first female co-pilot. And yeah, you know, we need more people like you on this particular program, or you're welcome to come back, of course. But the topics that I try to dive into are the ones that might make you scratch your head or think what the possibilities are, and kind of step beyond the average everyday photographic news of megapixels and dynamic range. And while sometimes that's useful, I think that it's a refreshing podcast, as I've heard from a lot of people that say, hey, you know, the stuff that you talk about, not many other people do, or you've got a different angle. And I knew right from the get-go, you'd be a good person to have on. We've had some scheduling conflicts getting you here, but I'm glad you're finally here. So what's been keeping you busy lately, Darlene?
Oh, my goodness. Well, I've been traveling quite a bit. I just spent 6 weeks in Medellin, Colombia, which I absolutely love, and contemplated changing my ticket and not coming home because I think I'm allergic to Canadian winters, so I want to get out of here as fast as possible. Spending a lot of time down there, I went primarily to actually work on my Spanish and studied intensive Spanish. I took 80 hours of Spanish lessons over 5 weeks. So I hope I'm doing pretty well. My goal is to be fluent in the next year or so, because I have a lot of Spanish readers and fans, and I just love Latin America and traveling to those countries. So that's what I've been doing.
Oh, that's fun. You know, I've been trying to learn more Bulgarian of all languages, because that's my wife's first language. And I mean, she's lived here in Canada for well over a decade, and we've known each other for the majority of that time. But we travel back to Bulgaria every, probably every summer or so. And learning the Cyrillic alphabet was a bit of a challenge. But when you realize that those characters, every character can only possibly make one sound. There's no mixed up words like the word circle, where the same letter in the same word has two different sounds. Everything, you might put the emphasis on the wrong syllable, but you won't get the sounds wrong.
Exactly.
And so I thought, that's brilliant. English is such a messed up language when it comes to, you know, other people trying to learn it. And so it makes me kind of feel their pain a little bit when I see the ease of other languages. But the grammar and the syntax of, I mean, they've got kind of like four different genders. There's masculine, feminine, neutral, and cute. So like if something is like a really cute thing, the end of the word is changed as a respect to that. And so I'm thinking to myself, I might learn to communicate, but I won't ever be writing anything professionally in some of these languages. It just won't make any sense grammatically. But it's fun. And my daughter, who is almost 2 years old now, is learning both English and Bulgarian.
Oh, that's great.
And so I'm learning through her all the key words like yes and no, and give, and things like here and there, and the basics.
Have to go potty, daddy.
Yeah, I'll make sure I recognize what that one is. Currently, it's sort of a sign language thing. It's like, oh, I know what you want right now. But life is fun, and learning, I think, as a photographer, I love to kind of just take a step back and try something new. And sometimes it's language. Sometimes it's just picking up a novel and reading a darn book. Because I just get so involved in my own work. I don't listen or appreciate the artistry of other people. And I do a lot of writing. And I find when I read a book and then I go back to writing something myself, my writing has improved.
Totally.
Yeah. And
I'm actually reading a book in Spanish right now. It's a kid's book. So I think it's aimed at like teens, but that's kind of like the reading level I'm at in my Spanish. And it's a really good exercise for vocabulary, which is, you know, what kids do. How do kids increase their vocabulary? They read. So that's my latest project is I want to read an entire book in Spanish.
Oh, that's fun. That's fun. And my latest project is I am currently experimenting with something called Curlian photography, which dates back to, the early 1900s, but was formally published in research in the late 1950s and became more prominent in the 1970s, where using high voltage and an electrified glass plate, putting something against that glass plate that is, flowing the electricity through it will create an electromagnetic or an electrified aura. And back in that time, there was a lot of nonsense and pseudoscience and parapsychology and stuff that says, oh, well, you know, this connects to your chi and you can do a palm reading based on, I don't believe any of that stuff. But playing around with 30,000 volts for photographic artistry, that's fun.
Interesting.
So, I mean, you get these lightning bolts, almost like you'd see coming off of a Tesla coil, bouncing off of the edge of a leaf. And so photographically, this hasn't been really explored more than the people trying to push pseudoscience around. So it's kind of fun to take a scientific approach to say, okay, yeah, this is the science. It's just pure high voltage and it's just kind of bouncing around. And how can you use that as a photographer to make something artistic? And I posted one image recently on my social media streams, and the response was generally pretty positive. So I've got this device on semi-permanent loan to me to experiment with, and over the summer I think I'll get maybe a dozen images that would be worth exploring, maybe making some articles or blog posts about. Maybe I'll write an article for the Digital Photography School, Darlene. You've been cool. Bugging me to do that for a long time on a variety of different topics. Cool. And I got to get back into that, so you got to bug me more on that one.
I will bug you, I promise.
Thanks. And I should mention, that's something that you also, curate stuff there. You are one of the managing editors, I believe, right?
I'm the only managing editor, DPS, and I also have my own site. So you're welcome to write for both of us, even.
Yes, Digital Photo Mentor is your other one, if I'm remembering
right.
Correctly.
That is me. And Digital Photo Photography School is technically Darren Rouse's site. But I control, like you said, I curate, I vet, I edit all the content that goes up there. And there's a lot of articles there.
And that's why it's so good.
We have like 6,000 articles. It's crazy.
Yeah. And I think I've written 4 or 5 in the past and generally pretty well received. So I gotta get back in the running there and come up with a few more. So that is my reminder. I should do that this coming week. I'm almost finished with my snowflake project, which I've got 5 more to do. And you mentioned how much you dislike winter. Mm-hmm. I am starting to detest it at this point.
Because you've been staring at snowflakes.
Well, and it takes me 4 to 5 hours to edit each one. So, you know, it's a lot of effort and monotonous effort. It's like knitting a sweater every day, just about. And, you know, at day 65 or 66, you're done with knitting sweaters. I mean, you don't want to pick up those knitting needles again at all, no matter how much TV you can watch while you do it. So that preamble aside, let's dig into the stories that we have. The first one I think is pretty interesting, that it hits a nostalgic chord for me. And I got to say, more power to this guy for failing so many times to get Kickstarter funding and then finally just hitting it out of the park with this one. So this is the I'm Back. That's the name of the project, I'm Back. And it is a digital back for analog SLRs. And so they are successfully funded right now, and that funding is going to continue to roll in for a little while. They still have some time. So if you're listening to this, go and check it out. The link is in the show notes. It is it amounts to basically having a focusing screen where the film would be and having a camera attached to a Raspberry Pi imaging that focusing screen in a little compartment that's underneath with some mirrors that let it see that screen up behind the camera. Darlene, do you have this nostalgic bend that, you know, you've got an old camera kicking around and you think, you know what, that it was fun to use back in the day. It was tactile. It had a wonderful experience. I loved using that camera, but there is no way I'm ever going to put a roll of film in that thing anymore.
Yeah, kind of. I mean, I actually have a bag full of 35mm film cameras that I picked up used for, I don't know, $50 a piece. Because once upon a time, I had this idea of doing a film-only workshop just here in Edmonton. And I never got around to it because the idea that I had was that people that are shooting digital don't have the experience of not being able to see their image, having limited number of shots, and having to, you know, manually focus and all those other things. So I wanted to be able to give people an experience of what that was like using a film camera. So, I mean, part of adding the digital back would take away that, you know, suspense of, okay, I can't see the picture right away. And, you know, you really got to check your settings to make sure you got everything right because you can't see the image. So I do have a bunch of cameras and it's kind of intriguing to me actually. But I think if I was going to pick up my film camera, I even have a Hasselblad in the closet, if you want Hasselblad. I would rather get a roll of film. But in my experience, it's harder and harder to even find a lab that will process any film anymore.
Yeah, you've got to send it away or do it yourself. And processing black and white film is not difficult. I mean, the chemicals and you know, a simple phone app like the Massive Dev Chart will show you all the times for the film and the developer and let you kind of tick things down on a clock. So it really becomes mechanical, hard to mess it up.
Yeah,
but you know, it does take time. The chemicals expire. You know, it's a commitment that you have to commit to keep using it. Otherwise, you're just never going to stay in that particular groove.
You got to have a well-ventilated area. And then if you want to get into color film, I mean, that's not really something you can do at home either.
It is, absolutely. But, you know, organic chemicals are less friendly than black and white chemistry. You can get C41 kits and E6 kits that are relatively simple to use. Temperature becomes the only real factor that you have to balance out and make sure that it stays consistent for the proper results. But they're close enough to room temperature that there's not going to be a whole lot of deviation. I find that when I pick up a film camera, though, and I've got a bunch of them just like you do, I want to embrace that full experience. You know, it's I kind of find this akin to taking a vinyl record and digitizing that through those digital turntables into an MP3 file. And it's not really the same thing. You know, if you're going vinyl, it's because that's the technology that you want to listen to the music on. And, you know, that's not my thing per se, but I know some people really enjoy that. And some people that enjoy film photography will be using film specifically. But I find, you mentioned the Hasselblad, that the medium format film world right now is the most viable, the most useful. If I'm going to take out a film camera, chances are I might be going on a photo walk or just having some fun. I'm not going to snap off 36 shots in a day unless I'm doing a rapid fire set of stuff, but that's what digital is for these days. So in that case, I don't think a 35mm camera is worth putting film in, and I might get some feedback that is negative on that, but I want the high resolution, I want the detail, and medium format bodies are cheaper than ever. You can pick up a used Hasselblad, Mamiya, whatever, for a fraction of the cost of what our digital cameras cost these days, and get some very, very useful images out of the most basic lens on those cameras, and scan them and have that a full digital workflow once they're scanned. And I think that's useful. But I wouldn't put film in a 35mm camera. I've got a Canon AE-1 that's my grandpa's old camera. And wouldn't it be fun if the next time I go and see them, they're getting on in years, but to take grandpa's old camera and say, hey, grandpa, take a look at this trick. He'll recognize the camera, and then I'll immediately show him a photograph taken from that. And there'll be a fun wow moment. There'll be a novelty. And I think that's what this is more about than doing anything meaningful in terms of production.
Where I see that it could have some interesting applications are, like, there's some really cool vintage lenses out there, right? Like we're talking, like, maybe you, like, go look at, like, a Canon 300-28 or something. You know, if you could pick up an old Canon 300-28 for wildlife or even a longer lens than that, you might be able to get one for a couple $100 versus, you know, paying for the EOS version and the newest, latest, greatest autofocus one. What is that worth? Like $10,000 plus or something now? I don't even know what that's worth. Like your leg and then some, right?
So exactly.
I could see if you wanted to get into wildlife photography, without the expense of, you know, the $10,000 lens, this could be a viable option, right? Because what is the back worth? A couple, $300 Canadian?
Well, it's 225 euro. So maybe a little bit more than that in the
Close
Canadian
to 400
dollar.
Bucks. So $400 Canadian plus a lens. I mean, for less than $1,000, you're out shooting wildlife if that's your, you know,
right.
That's your
and now it's not going to be the best sensor in the world. It's probably not going to keep pace. They don't even mention things like frame rate and what have you. I think that might be more limited by the camera operating it than anything else. But if that's the case, Darlene, why don't you just, you've got probably, if you're listening to this podcast, a good digital camera already. Why don't you just buy the adapter, of which there are multitudes of, to take that cheap lens and put it on your existing digital camera? And it's a different experience, of course. So this all has to boil down to what experience you're after. But the fact is that for a couple of $100s, you can take, and there's a universal back that comes with this thing. So you can just throw it on any film cameras that you have, or you can get a dedicated back for it. It's not perfect for every camera, by the way, because I've got this Leica 3F here. And if anybody's familiar with the old Leica 3s, they don't actually have a back. The plate on the bottom comes off and you load in the film that way. And so the back is non-removable. And so on some cameras, you can't get access to the film plane in the same way that this device would normally be useful for. But I still think it's cool. And by the way, if I look at their timeline here, which I did see on their website, and I'm not seeing it right now, but I had seen previous failed attempts at this from the same guy with different versions of this. And he's finally, he didn't give up. There has been, I don't know how many attempts, 4 or 5 at least.
Yeah, I saw that. I think it was 2013 he did his first one. Yeah, here it is. 2015, his first one, 2016. Yeah, so this is like the fifth iteration of it.
And he doesn't give up. And now it's successfully funded to the tune of, as we're recording this, about $55,000 Canadian with 143 backers. And I hope we might be able to get a few more people interested in this for the novelty factor. I mean, this is not going to be anything of real production quality. But I also say that about a lot of art lenses, you know, from Lomography or Meyer Optic or any of these different companies. And I've sold prints and I've had prints in galleries from that as well. So prove me wrong, people. but this is out there and it's a fun way to revitalize those old cameras if you don't want to get truly invested back into the film world, but you want to just have a lark with an old collection of cameras and share the results. So yeah.
Does he say anywhere that you could see about the sensor size or the crop factor? Like, is it going to be the full size of the 35 millimeter negative?
Yeah, because the camera images a focusing screen that is, I think it looks to be 36 millimeters by 24 millimeters.
Yeah.
So it while the actual camera has a much smaller sensor than that, that doesn't matter because it's imaging a focusing screen. So the lens is projecting the image onto that surface. And then the camera inside the device is capturing that. So you get the depth of field and the feel of the full frame 35 millimeter format with the setup.
Yeah, I could definitely see throwing like a Holga or the Diana on there for some really cool, fun stuff.
Yeah, fun and enjoyable. And I've got a hard time with photography being too much about, you know, paying the bills sometimes. And I've got to find every possible way to just make things fun and just enjoy it. And I don't care if I get a commercially viable photograph. I just get something that's curious for me. And anything that tickles the curiosity, just like this thing, I think is worth checking out. So,
well, I'm gonna give a precursor hint to my pick of the week because you mentioned having fun. And that's the one thing. So my Fuji, I bought the X100F to go along with my X-T1, and I absolutely love this camera. You know, it's fixed lens, 23 millimeter on a crop sensor, and it's perfect for street photography. But I actually shoot JPEG with it quite a bit because it's put the fun back in photography. There's fun picture modes. I'll hand it to my niece or my nephew, and they can go shoot with it. You know, it's small, it's lightweight.
All right, well, hold on. I want to hear that in the pic section. Okay. You're stealing your own thunder here. Getting ahead of yourself. But let's take a look at the next topic, which kind of brings that same kind of curiosity for what might come of this. From Google, they have released into, I'm not going to say the public domain, but at least open sourced, The technology that is in the Pixel 2 and the Pixel 2 XL, that is the portrait mode, the underlying workings of this portrait mode, the DeepLab V3 Plus, implemented in TensorFlow for anybody that cares. That's all gobbledygook to us. But if we talk about what this actually is, this is the technology that allows Google to, on a pixel by pixel basis, define what the object in the frame is. So if it's a person, if it's a person on a bicycle and the background behind that, you can actually separate the background from the bicycle from the person and identify those as separate objects within the frame. Now, Apple does this as well, and a lot of other companies are working on this technology to separate the background from the foreground, to blur it and create this portrait mode effect. But the fact that Google just went and said, yep, everybody can use this, it's open source, that kind of puts it into all the indie developer realm now. And anybody that is an upstart, you know, you are your only employee, or you've got a team of 5 or 10 people working on products to make a really cool camera app. Well, if you roll this kind of technology into the way you process an image, I think you could have a lot of fun with that. What are your initial thoughts on this, Darlene, in terms of the technology and what the possibilities might be?
I did a further research besides the link that you gave me in terms of what it was all about and the whole portrait mode and how it works with the, you know, dual cameras or with a single camera. And my first thought was, wow, this is amazing. You know, like the fact that it's able to take this tiny little lens in your smartphone and just the difference between one side of the lens to the other, it can tell if the background it's a background or it's the subject, which is closer. So it's amazing technology, and it was amazingly accurate. Where it's going to go actually is really interesting, but there's a lot of – I've heard some discussion on, you know, this portrait mode is going to do away with professional photographers. People are just going to shoot with their phones. You know, SLRs are going to go the way of the dodo bird, all these things. And I don't think it's quite there yet, but – it was kind of like, do you remember the Lytro or the, what was a camera that could shift the focus? You know, everybody thought that was
Lytro. Yeah. And the last consumer product they made was the Illum. And we talked about that on this podcast in a previous episode, I think earlier in the year when they came out with, it was a commercial failure for them on the consumer level. Yeah. But in the professional market, they've got some beastly arrays of like 100 cameras all in this weird contraption to do 6 degrees of motion for VR videography. So you can move left and right, up and down, and rotate left and right, rotate up and down, and move around in this entire space to just feel like it's 100% immersive. You can't replicate that without having this massive array of cameras. But we're starting to get into this realm where computational photography mm-hmm. can give us more artistic choices that we wouldn't otherwise have unless you're, you know, digging up Photoshop. And, you know, imagine a bicycle in an image that is red in color. Mm-hmm. What if that's the only thing in the image that you want to have in color, you know, selective color, but there's other red things in the frame. Maybe the rest of the image is mostly red. Well, you can selectively say, hey, that bicycle stays in color. The rest of the image becomes black and white. That's a love it or hate it thing, but hey, that's a possibility once you define the objects. What if you want the background to be darker because the background's really distracting? You could selectively edit the background to be darker than the foreground or vice versa to choose exactly how the different subjects kind of gel together. Maybe one person is in the shadows, and maybe it could separate different people and say that one person, can we brighten that person back up? Mm-hmm. So from just a simple like tapping on a screen and possibly editing the different ingredients here, once this algorithm makes it into software that is consumer facing, that have the freedom of their own artistry and the ability to just take risks on producing new and different features, I think that this is a great artistic tool for post-processing on a smartphone where you can't get into the 747 cockpit view of Photoshop to start discerning these different things. If just by the very nature of the data collected, you can differentiate between objects and edit it accordingly, I think it's a really powerful thing. And And it will be growing. This is only a growing area of photography, and it'll get better and better as time continues.
That was my thought as well. Like, as I was reading through it, it's like, okay, what are the applications of this? And, you know, if you can edit that mask, because right now it's just in a smartphone and it does it automatically, but give the user the ability to edit that mask. And like you said, do change different things about it. But something you said also kind of made me think of something different. Like you said, it gives us artistic choices. However, if you go to the other side of the coin, there's the purists who are then going to say, okay, is this even photography anymore? It's doing it all for us. You know, when is it a machine and it's not art anymore? It's not photography. Because some people don't even consider, you know, digital photography or any editing at all. I mean, those are the real purists. That's not art. That's not photography.
Well, here's the thing. If you're a real purist, then just go take insurance photographs. Go, you know, maybe you're a photojournalist and no editing is involved and what have you. But, you know, you look back to the greats that everybody's familiar with. Ansel mm-hmm. Adams is the perfect example of this,
yep,
where he
totally.
Would spend hours, like an entire day in the darkroom perfecting a print.
His entire zone system is about manipulating the image.
Exactly. And it's in the film era of photography. Mm-hmm. And so when people think, oh, well, you know, digital photography is a lot different than film. In film, it was real. Mm-hmm. No.
No. What about a filter on a black and white image, right? You put a red filter on a black and white film, you're changing the image completely.
You're changing it entirely. And, you know, if you ever had film that you just dropped off at the 1 hour photo place to get developed, there are, I mean, if it's C41, it's pretty much mechanically the same. But if they're making prints from that, they're often color correcting the prints. Mm-hmm. I know I worked at Black's Photography for a number of years. And when we would make prints from negatives, we would have to correct for all the color casts. And the automatic process was usually not good. And the technician operating the machine would just nudge things left and right a little bit, you know, get rid of that cyan cast here, or, you know, this one's a bit too warm, whatever it happened to be. Mm-hmm. And then you get the prints. They've been manipulated before
totally.
You even get them.
Totally.
There is no such thing as pure. As a concrete reality. You know, the I'm here talking to you, Darlene. And if I were to remember the conversation tomorrow, I might forget half of what we talked about. I hope I don't, but there will be some gaps, I can imagine. Memory is subjective as well. So there are three basic versions of reality that I would consider: what the camera captures, what we see, and what we remember. And really, it's what we remember that is the most important thing in the day-to-day life. You know, if we look back to any memory, that memory is very important to us. So I like to take my images, and if I'm doing a landscape or a portrait or whatever, I make the image closer to what I remember it to be than what I saw in that particular scene or what the camera was able to capture, because the camera is fundamentally seeing the world from a different perspective than we are. And if you want to play by the camera is reality, then you are rejecting the world that you live in.
Ooh, that's a bold statement. Put that in quotes on the show notes.
Yeah, exactly. But yeah. I don't like people compositing images and lying about it. You know, I don't like people trying to make something appear to be realistic
sure.
when it clearly is not.
Sure. If you're going to make a composite, then call it what it is, right? And then there's the debate of, you know, is that still photography, right? Because you've combined different things. I had an interesting story. Is I used to be a member of PPOC, Professional Photographers of Canada, and my background is, I mean, I've been literally doing this for 30 years. So I'm half of my career has been film and half has been digital. So I feel like I have a unique perspective. So when everything started changing over into digital was around sort of 2004, 2005, when the majority of people were going digital, the categories for entering into competition with the PPOC changed. They had some for prints, regular prints, and some for digital entries. And not just you could submit a digital file and they would, you know, judge it on a screen, but the categories were completely separate. So there was one award for portrait of the year and there was one award for digital portrait of the year. And then some of us were scratching our head going, well, isn't a portrait? What's the difference? And at the time, some of the older members, I mean, we're talking, you know, these guys were in 60s and 70s at the time, you know, they said, I kid you not, the same thing happened when color film came out. They said we had two categories, one for black and white and one for color, because they were afraid that this new technology somehow gave those people an advantage over the other people using the old technology.
That's funny. And you know, I am still a member of PPOC and I'm on the fence about it because, I mean, I enter their photographic contest, the PPOC National Image Salon. Mm-hmm. And like, I'll throw out some weird images in the experimental category. Like this year I threw in a 3D image that you're supposed to cross your eyes and see it in 3D. Nobody got it. Nobody even figured out what that was supposed to be.
Of course not.
Even though I labeled it in the title of the image, CrossView 3D. And they just thought, oh, that title is confusing. This image makes no sense to us. Okay, you know, I get that. I understand that when I throw something in that category, most people probably won't get it. But some of my best images over the last year were submitted into this particular contest. And I'm going to share this image. I'm going to put it in the show notes. But I'm putting it on the screen for you to take a look at it right now, Darlene. What do you think about this particular photograph here?
It kind of looks composite.
It's like not a composite whatsoever.
It's not. Okay, so we see a bog and a blue
this
flower.
This is an image of a green immigrant leaf weevil on a flower floating on the surface of water with a Gerbera daisy in the background that is just for color purposes to just kind of fill in the rest of the frame. There's four rankings in the image salon. There's unaccepted, accepted, merit, and excellence.
Yep.
And this one was unaccepted.
You're kidding.
Unaccepted.
What was the category it entered into?
I can't remember. It was either wildlife or fine art or something of those regards. But the response was, it was too bright.
Mm.
Okay. I don't think that's right. I mean, yeah, sure. There are some highlights on the flower petals that might be somewhat distracting to some degree. But, to me, this is one of my most successful images of the last year. It has been printed many times and I've sold a bunch of prints of it and it received a lot of acclaim online. So this is a single frame edited very lightly, just, you know, the brightness and contrast adjustments and what have you, maybe a bit of sharpening here and there. Nobody liked it. And so I'm thinking, especially if you think about people like PPOC, the Professional Photographers of Canada. We should explain what that acronym means.
PPA, which is American version of that.
Exactly. They tailor themselves to kind of the old guard of photographers, the portraiture, the wedding people, mm-hmm. and a lot of their content is kind of befitting of those genres. And they really haven't done much for me. They did put me in contact with my copyright lawyer that I use quite regularly.
Excellent.
And so, I mean, there's one win for them, but I haven't really found the advantage of paying almost $400 a year to be a part of this club.
There's a whole other topic. I think that's a whole podcast. Our association's, outdated because I haven't been a member for probably 7 years now, and same reasons. I feel like there's in all honesty, I mean, I was a member of PPOC from 1991, 1993 till 2011. And I got a lot out of it in the early days because, the internet was new. You know, can you imagine? There was almost no internet. Learning online was unheard of, all these, things. So I think that there's a lot more opportunities online now for somebody who doesn't have to travel to a conference to attend a thing to learn something than there was, 20 or 30 years ago. But to bring us back to this whole technology thing, I think that's true. I think everything's speeding up, like we're talking about advances and things and whether or not associations are keeping up. Are we keeping up with this technology? Like what are we going to do with that? Like if that comes into play and somebody has access to that on their phone or on their point and shoot or, even in their Olympus camera, like what's to say that the big brands don't pick that up? You pick up an entry-level Sony or Olympus mirrorless camera with your basic kit lens and throw that technology on. Now you're doing, portrait work with a $500 kit instead of a pro, considered a pro level.
Exactly. A lot of those cameras have touch screens on them. So this kind of interface could be very easily done on a smartphone or any of the mirrorless cameras that are on the market today too. So while this technology, I think, is still in its infancy, it is going to be a huge disruption in the industry moving forward. And I'm kind of excited to see what possibilities there are to say, okay, well, Can I take two separate shots that in one image it defined a beautiful sky and in the other image it defined the landscape and the people in it, and just do an automatic sky replacement just with the artificial intelligence having defined those parameters in different photographs?
Yeah. Boom, there you go.
I mean, that technology can do it. I don't think it's been implemented that you could do that in camera or in phone yet. But once you make those differentiations, and they're good, so that, you know, it is the proper boundaries between these different objects. And there's tons of cherry-picked examples of how it works really well. And I'm sure there's a bunch of scenarios where it will fail miserably, but this is a constant learning process. These algorithms are based on a bucket of knowledge. And as that knowledge grows, then the algorithms that are applied to it will continue to get better and better. And as processing power improves and everything else improves, photography becomes more and more about what the image can be versus what light was collected. Mm-hmm. And I think that as photographers, if you're not embracing that to some degree, then you're going to be left behind. And I'm not saying specifically that, oh, I want to massively manipulate all of my photographs. That's not going to be the thing that keeps me interested in this. But I am saying that the writing is on the wall. You know, we have to be paying attention to this. Yeah. Okay, I've said my piece. I'll get off my soapbox.
I think you're right in the experimentation and playing around, going back to that word play, is key to staying interested in it. And I think, like, I've taught a lot of classes and I get some people in my classes that say they want to go professional or do it professionally or even part-time. And, you know, then there's a whole debate of full frame versus not full frame and all this kind of stuff. But what I get people to think about when they say, oh, I'm considering, you know, going full-time or going professional is, you know, what's going to change if you do that? Because it changes the game. You go from somebody who's doing photography solely for themselves, for the purpose of enjoyment, to now you have to please other people, you have to do marketing, you have to do accounting, you have to do sales and have a website and a blog and all these things. And, you know, the joke is that a photography business is 10% photography and 90% business, but it's about accurate. And so you really have to consider, do you want to be in business or do you want to do photography? Like, what is it that you're passionate about? So I've actually discouraged some people from going into business because it's not, they feel like that then they'll have arrived if they can say they're a professional. I'm a real photographer because I charge money. But I know a lot of so-called amateurs that do way better work than some so-called professionals.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, we're in a world too, where, you know, if you get that one in a million shot, that thing that all the news outlets want to make go viral or what have you, you're probably not going to charge them for it if you're just an amateur photographer or you're not in the business of it. And, you know, if you have that really killer shot of, you know, XYZ, it doesn't matter what it is. But if you're an amateur, you're doing it for the love of it and for the fun of creating that. And you wouldn't mind seeing that show up in a magazine or on a TV program. But the professionals out there that are trying to get that same shot, and maybe they've got a few similar ones, but again, there's a million people getting that one in a million shot. Mm-hmm. It's going to show up. So then the professionals are then competing against free. And so this is kind of an interesting paradigm where as a professional, you have to be at the utmost top of your game, probably in specific niches. You know, you've got to mm-hmm. be a great wedding photographer. If you're taking pictures for a specific client, you know, you can't source those from anybody else. They have to come from you. But in terms of content that's going to be printed in a textbook, you know, you have to be the best at something. It can be obscure. It can be a tiny little niche. I've just wrapped up some documentary film projects working on snowflakes and ultraviolet fluorescence because, you know, I'm pretty good in those areas. And they're very, very small niches that fewer people are playing in. Maybe mm-hmm. I'll do something with that curly in photography with those 30,000 volts and get something interesting happening from that. I don't know. But as a professional, I find myself pursuing these niches. And thankfully, I love science. I love geeking out and problem solving and troubleshooting. And if I don't get a good image, I'm still enjoying the creation process. And I can have fun with that. But I also have to remind myself, yeah, if this doesn't work out for a good image, you're just having fun. You're not paying the bills. And you got to get back to that at some point.
That's exactly it. And I mean, as I've sort of transitioned through my career, I've gone through, I've done commercial photography, tabletop product, food, industrial, you know, editorial work. And then I did portraits and weddings for years. I did gallery stuff for years. And then I got into travel photography and teaching, and that's where I'm at now. And most of the shooting that I do is non-commissioned. It's just for me or for, you know, showing the tours that I lead and places that I go and so on, and for teaching purposes. So generally when I'm going to shoot, like, for example, you know, I go to New York once a year and I do a photo walk, and we just go and have fun. And yeah, it took me probably this long in my career, 30 years, to get to a place where I don't have to do anything with the images either. That's the other thing. You know, we have so many images on our hard drives and in our archives. And I was always stressing about, oh, I got to get to all these images. You know, I got to do something with them. No, I realize I don't. I just, if I only take one picture in this moment and then I never look at it again or never show it to anybody or share it, that's enough, because I felt inspired in that moment to take that picture. And that's, for me, that's what it's about.
Bravo. You know, very, very well said. And I think that as the industry continues to evolve, as content gets consumed in many different ways, I think that, you know, that archive of images will be perpetually useful for you. You know, I was talking with a company, and I don't know if I can announce anything yet, but I told them, hey, you know, what if we could record the maker notes area of metadata in every camera file? This is the camera manufacturer specific information that can be read by programs like EXIF tool. What if we could keep that in the final resulting image? And what if we could sort through that data later in interesting ways? Because there's lots of fun tidbits of information in there that right now we don't have access to because it gets deleted whenever an image is edited. What if that is still there? And then what if we could start searching through, like, when I use my Canon MPE 65mm macro lens, it changes its magnification from 1x to 5x, and it records that magnification factor in the maker notes. Hmm. What if I could search through all of my images and sort them by magnification? Mm-hmm. And that would be a lot of fun. That would be really cool. And I could rediscover some images that I wouldn't have otherwise found. But the final story that we're going to be talking about today is again, it's forward-facing, you know, future-looking in this episode. To a new phone we've talked about once previously, I think, on this podcast, from Red, the Red Hydrogen, which is a smartphone that promises 3D and what they're calling 4V content to be not only viewed on the device, but created by the device. And so I actually have one of these cameras on pre-order. I've paid, I think, $1,600 to pre-order one of these things in titanium. It is not a cheap device. And they've just canceled the pre-orders. They've stopped allowing pre-orders for them as they're preparing for the rollout to carriers and everything else, which should be in the summer or a little bit later than that. And a new bit of information has come out. One of the founding people at Red that has one of the prototypes in hand is slowly dishing out more and more information on this, and I'm just lapping it up. Darlene, I know that you've read a little bit about this, and it's kind of an introduction to you to this. So I don't want to fill in all the blanks here. What do you think about this technology, and will this be useful for us moving forward, or is this just going to be a novelty that is a kind of a splash in the pan that is a big wow factor for a brief period of time, and then nobody cares about it afterwards?
Yeah, really hard to say. I mean, when I was reading about it, it took me a while to figure out what, you know, 4V meant and this whole 3D thing. So they're talking about like a holographic image. And I did think about Princess Leia with the R2-D2 and the image of her projected. I don't know. I can't see an application for it. It could be fun. It would be cool. You know, I could see kids getting excited about it. But at that price, I mean, of course, introduction price is always going to be high, but $1,600 US, that's more than I paid for my camera, you know? So where does it end?
Like, well, I splurged on the one that was in titanium. They did have an aluminum one as well. That was, I think, $1,100. And then the price went up a little bit afterwards.
Still pricey. I mean, what does an iPhone go for? I mean, like, those are ridiculous prices.
Well, about $1,000 for the iPhone X, if you're buying it outright. So, I mean, it's a little bit more than the high-end iPhone, but what Red is promising here with this device is something really impressive. It says, and I'm going to quote here, that it will include many options in terms of modules that will add on to the device. So this is designed as Red does with their cameras, mm-hmm. as the core component that you'll build on top of. So many options to support 2D image capture, 3D to 4V capture, and A3D, which is spatial audio at the highest level. So there will be add-ons to this phone that will make a mirrorless camera part of what is in your pocket. I don't know if they will have interchangeable lenses or what have you. It's all mired in secrecy right now. But many options for that and 3D to 4V. I would love to have a 3D camera, something that I play around with a lot, that has two really good lenses at about human pupil distance apart to do the same kind of 3D perception that we have. And then take that picture with this phone and show it to people, not needing for them to wear glasses at all to see a 3D representation of the world do that in video. Wouldn't that be fantastic for recording memories and making them feel more like you were there?
Alive. Interesting. Do you remember, or did you ever see any of those historical photographs, the stereographs, where you had to put them in these binocular looking things where it had the two pictures?
Oh, I got a bunch of those. And in fact, the earliest one of those I have is from 1867. So that's 150 years old as a stereoscope.
So we've been trying to make 3Ds for 150 years.
Oh, longer than that even. And at the time when that was introduced, I mean, we didn't have TV, of course, and radio may or may not have existed. I'm not even sure. But if you wanted to see the world and really perceive it beyond your own town or village, you know, you could take a stereo view of the Eiffel Tower and feel like you were there, knowing that you will never in your lifetime get to go and experience that. And they were big during the war times as well to help feel like you were there, you know, part of the fight sort of thing. Or at least closer to it and making it more meaningful. So there was a lot of wartime footage from World War I done in stereo. And I've got some of that, some of those original stereo views. But the fun thing is, and this is kind of fun, if I take my my stereo images that I've taken today and I load them into my smartphone and I put them into that 150-year-old stereo viewer, it fits perfectly within those little legs that hold a stereo card in place, and I can use my phone as a method to see that. Now, how many people actually have a phone full of stereo views and a stereoscope to view them? There's a huge barrier to entry there. But if this technology can take off and allow me to record and show off 3D images. And they're saying, this is the kind of the hidden dragon in this post. We are also developing, this is a quote from Jannard. We are also developing a line of prosumer and professional 3D to 4V cameras to support the system. That's interesting. That's huge. I mean, the R&D development that Red is going to have to put into to develop a line of prosumer and professional 3D cameras, that's not something to just, you know, scoff at. That's, they're very serious about this. And if they're that serious about it, then I think I made a good investment with this particular new phone, and I don't think it's going to go out of date. I imagine that this phone, even when the tech inside of it becomes outdated, I'm going to keep it, and I'm going to use it just to show off photos to people, whether it's just in my studio or maybe hand it off to my grandparents with a bunch of family photos done in 3D, and they can be reliving them. I took some images recently with a stereoscopic camera that I have that's always on my desk here. I'm always reminded that I need to use this more often. A Relitoscope from 1926. And a medium format camera that takes 2 6x6 frames. And I took that on a photo walk to down in Toronto. And I took a group photo of everybody with this particular camera, and I put it into a glorified ViewMaster on steroids, because it takes those 6x6 centimeter slides I was shooting on and uses them as the image source. And you feel just like you're back in that moment. It is so incredible the way that this really immerses you in the content that you're viewing. More so than whenever I've ever gone to a cinema and saw a movie in 3D. Some of those have just been so poorly done.
Cheesy.
And cheesy, and the tech is getting there, but not quite there. And I think this gets it there. So,
however, have you ever been to an IMAX 3D?
I have, and that was awesome.
Now you feel like you're in the
I saw Avatar in IMAX 3D, and I thought that was really impressive. I didn't get a chance to see the latest Star Wars film in the IMAX version of it, but I did see that in 3D as well, and it was remarkably well done. If you do 3D content wrong, it can be nauseating or disorienting, especially when the stereo window has to be set such that if you have objects that have a stereoscopic effect in one image for one eye, but it's out of the frame from the other eye, then it kind of pulls your eye to that disorientation along the edges of the frame. So you have to compose things and edit things very carefully in 3D to make sure that that doesn't happen.
I remember attending an IMAX movie at the Edmonton Klondike days, you know, they have this tent and you go in and like we're standing and the screen was massive and you just stand there and watch this thing. And I remember having to close my eyes because I was getting dizzy. Like I was actually going to fall down or throw up watching this thing. So yeah, it's very, very lifelike. But my question about this technology with this camera is, okay, so let's say they have this thing and you could take the 3D, you could take this holographic image or however it's projected, but then do you not need that device to then show it to other people or to see it? Like you can't send that to somebody else and have them have the same experience with that file, correct?
So they're working with the social media platforms and they haven't named names yet, but if anybody is viewing that image on a device that is capable of viewing it in 3D, they will be able to view it in 3D. If they are not on such a device, they will see a 2D version of it. So they're kind of making it backwards compatible in that regard. And as more and more devices are compatible with this technology, then it will, you know, catch on a bit more, I hope. The problem here is that the company that produces the screen is owned by Red. And so I hope that Red is like willing to license for pennies on the dollar just to get this out there into other manufacturers so that it becomes available in more and more products than just their own. Because I don't think Red is going to get a huge market share in the smartphone market. I mean, maybe they'll prove me wrong, but they're a camera manufacturer, not a smartphone manufacturer, and this is their first foray into it. If that tech can be licensed and put into the latest Samsung or Apple phone, then that's where it's going to make a bigger difference in terms of general acceptance and consumability. But that's not going to happen unless the social media platforms are already supporting it. It's a bit of a chicken and egg scenario here.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. I mean, it's kind of like, you know, when people came out with beta versus VHS. I mean, we're going back to the 80s now. Beta never caught on, right? And you have to, it's like a fax machine. You know, you got the first fax machine, somebody else has to have one to receive a fax, right?
Exactly.
Or an email address, somebody else has to have one to receive it. So yeah, it's got to be two-way.
I have Betamax footage of my third birthday party from a broadcast camera that my dad was working as an electronics repair technician and fixed this camera, needed to test it, and my birthday was around that time. So I discovered a Betamax tape in my closet. What the hell do I do with this now?
Yeah.
You know, I ended up finding a Betamax player on eBay, which cost me way more than I expected to. And I resold it for almost the same amount. So I recouped that cost. But, if you get content on a medium that is no longer accessible in the future, then is it worthwhile? Because what if social media platforms say, hey, this is a great thing, and then pull support after 5 years because, hey, that didn't catch on. So why are we carrying this forward? There is a risk there for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's kind of like, you know, like floppy disks have gone bye-bye and CDs for the most part have now as well. So all this, do you remember backing up your computer on a tape, for heaven's sake? Like all this stuff is totally irrelevant. Like I don't even have a CD drive in my laptop. I can't play a CD.
Yeah. And you don't need to. And so that's the, if you ever needed to, you can go and buy one and they've got them with USB ports and
yeah,
they
I've
just
got
plug
in.
But,
one. Yeah.
So there, and you can get a USB floppy disk drive if you wanted that, if you had any reason for it. If you are still shooting with a Sony Mavica and are recording your images to a floppy disk and you need to carry that back to your computer, you can still do that today if you really wanted to. But it's most certainly not the norm. Anyhow, I'm looking forward to seeing what comes of that, and I will have a firsthand, review of this device once I get a chance to show my existing 3D content on it and create some. But man, Red is really stepping into some risky waters here, and I'm thrilled for it. I hope that they have the greatest success with that. All right, that brings us
into
our...
Interestingly enough, I was curious about my own cell phone package while we were talking, and because I'm interested to get. I'm a Samsung person, so I have the S7. The Samsung S9 is $959 Canadian dollars. So you're, the one that you got was, what was this?
It came to just over $2,000 Canadian with the current exchange when that happened. Yeah, so I'm paying twice that.
Double. Yeah.
But double that. I'm investing in the possibilities here. And so we'll see.
Taking a leap of faith.
And my phone is made of titanium. So there's that.
Wow.
Exactly.
So it shouldn't break if you drop it.
That it is solid. They're saying that it is. It's going to be slightly bigger than the iPhone X, and much more solid with a 4,500 milliamp hour battery, which is kind of unheard of, and speakers that are more audiophile esque than what you would normally find in a smartphone as well. So they're really rounding it out to make it as good as it can be.
Technology really has come a long way. I mean, it's amazing. Like I lead photo tours, and one of the ladies on my tour last year to Morocco, we were at the mosque in Casablanca. It's very famous, and Hassan II Mosque, and we're all shooting nighttime shots. And then we started getting some lightning happening. So people were like, "Oh, I want to try and capture some lightning." So we were, you know, trying to leave our shutter open. Nobody had any fancy triggers or anything. I seriously, she takes out her Samsung S7. She puts it on burst mode. She fires away. She gets a lightning shot on her phone. She's the only one that got the shot. I kid you not.
What time of day was that?
Like dusk, like blue hour.
Right. So in that time, what I would typically do is I'd set the camera on continuous shooting with, I've done it at a 2-second exposure if there's still a little bit of ambient light, and then just hammer down the shutter button. So if you have a wired trigger that has a locking feature on that, you could lock that down, and then it'll just take one shot after the next. And with a 2-second delay, it's never going to fill up the buffer in the camera. You'll fill up your memory card first. And so if the lightning crashes across the frame in that case, then it'll work. And I found around 20 seconds work when you're completely at night. But if you have too much light, then you've got to do that rapid fire burst at a pace that, you know, you're going to, you know, be shooting at, I don't know, 5-10 frames a second. You're not going to get the shot before your buffer fills up, unless you're lucky.
That was the thing. Yeah. I mean, we were in the city, so there's city lights and all these things. Right. And but I just thought it was ironic that she got the shot with her phone and all the rest of us, you know, had our stuff out on tripods and we didn't get it.
Okay. So let's go into camera recommendations now, because for the picks of the week, I think we both have cameras in mind, Darlene.
We do.
And I want you to go first, because you kind of teased yours earlier, the X100F.
The Fuji, yes. So I switched actually last year from Canon to Fuji. I bought my Fuji about 3 years ago, my X-T1, and I absolutely love it. And partly the reason I went with the Fuji X-T1 because I'd been looking at mirrorless for a while. I'd looked at the Sonys. I'd tried the Olympus, and they just didn't feel right. You know, like when you pick up a camera. And when I picked up the Fuji at the camera store, I instantly had that retro feel, like you were talking about earlier with a film camera, because the thing that struck me the most is there's an aperture ring on the lens. And I was like, yay, that's exciting to me. Like, I was actually excited about that. There's an ISO ring and a dial, and everything had a dial. You know, I didn't have to do buttons to get into stuff. So that's what spurred me to start going down the Fuji track. And I kept my Canon stuff for a couple years, and I just realized finally last year, I'm not using it. So I've now sold it all. I got none left. And I picked up the X100F last August, just before I went to New York. And I was super excited about it. I'd been wanting it for a while. And that's all I took to New York and did my whole photo walk with just that camera. You can get little screw-on lenses for it, either a telephoto, which makes it like about a 50, or a wider one. I'm not sure what kind of focal length that is equating to, but it's just super fun. You know, like you grab a camera, it weighs less than a pound, I think, anyways, and go.
It's a tactile experience, right? Yep. And it's simple. You've got that one lens. You're not going to be carrying around, you know, 5 different lenses in your camera bag. And I'm going to assuming, because it's gotten praise from you, that the image quality is top-notch as well.
same sensors in the XT1, basically, or the XT2. Yeah, same technology. The only difference is, you know, that you've got a fixed lens. And some people feel like that's a limitation, which it is, but so is shooting with a 50 mil. And I recommend doing that with your SLR anyways. So, I mean, I did a review of the camera on my site, and I did a, you know, who is this for and who's it's not for. And I would suggest that if you want a second camera, something that's just this easy and fun, pick that up. If you're looking for it as a primary camera, it's probably not going to serve all your needs, because your 23 millimeter lens, you know, shooting that grizzly bear, probably not a good idea.
Keep your distance in that regard. Yeah. But for street photography, for person photography, you know, if you're doing just the casual family get together and taking some snaps of people, your cell phone could work. But if you want to kick it up a notch, this thing, I mean, it easily fits in your purse, your pocket, and can make a pretty, I want to say a beautiful image, but that always depends on the photographer. But it gives you all the potential, all of the tools that you need to make it happen. And I've been testing the Panasonic GX9, the Lumix GX9 over the past little while. I got a copy of it earlier in the wintertime, just before they made the official announcement of it. And I should say, I've got to give it back to Panasonic. They don't sponsor me. I just, I begged them to have me sign a non-disclosure agreement to get one beforehand. And they did. It is phenomenal. This GX9 is a 20 megapixel sensor, no anti-aliasing filter, so you get a really nice clean image. I haven't been able to process any of the raw files, so that's the only thing that I can't talk about for this camera yet, because nobody supports it yet. It's not actually in many people's hands. But I've been using it for macro photography. I've been using it for portraiture of my daughter, who's 2 years old and does not sit still. The focusing is good. The camera is It's heavy for its size, which I like. I like a camera that doesn't feel like it's going to blow away in the wind. And it has, like you said, those dials and knobs and switches. And it's got an I'm gapping on this right now. The exposure compensation is on a dial specifically as well, which they've had on more and more cameras lately. And I love, because it just, I don't have to go through a menu. I feel for what dial that is. If I take a picture really quickly, oh, that's too bright, without even taking a second thought, I just move a dial two notches to the left and take another picture, and it's perfect without having to fumble around and missing the moment. And the camera shouldn't be a barrier to making a picture. It should be something that is like the back of your hand. You know it, you understand it, you can feel your way around it and make it work. And this camera has done that for me. In fact, I've been putting together a couple of gallery exhibitions lately, and one that I currently have on right now, it's coming down on Sunday in Rochester, New York, featured one of those images. And this particular photograph was sold, actually. So not only has it been accepted into a gallery exhibition, but it's sold in that exhibition as well, shot with the GX9. So it has an interchangeable lens. I was using, for that image that sold in the gallery, the Leica 45 millimeter macro, and which I love. But honestly, if I were to use a cheaper macro lens, it would probably perform very, very well for the kind of stuff that I do. Corner sharpness and fast focusing don't really make a huge difference for these kinds of images. But at the same time, I'm left thinking, okay, can this replace my Canon gear? You know, this tiny camera, it's not a flagship camera from Panasonic. It's not the GH5 or the G9 or anything like that. But can it replace that gear? And I don't think that it can. I wouldn't use this as my primary camera. But as soon as I have the opportunity to buy one, this is going in my camera bag as a backup camera. It's going to be a behind-the-scenes camera. It's going to be the camera that I take traveling. It's going to be the camera that, when I can't carry the massive 1D series camera body with me, I will always have this next to me. And it's been fun to use. And I think that's really what this all boils down to, that we enjoy using these cameras. And mixing the two together of enjoying it and making money with it, I've been able to do that with it. So, you know, thumbs up from me on the GX9. Still not a huge fan of optical or of electronic viewfinders. And I've seen them all from Sony and Olympus, Panasonic and Fuji. They're great and they're getting better over time, but I'm still holding on to my optical viewfinder. I just, I've had a love affair with my optical viewfinder for a long time, and it's what I started with as a photographer. It's the technology that lets me see the world, in the dynamic range of human vision. And I don't think that the electronic viewfinders are quite there yet. But you might, I'm not sure if the conversation is going to sync together properly. We had some technical issues, and we thought we were going to have to re-record the entire conversation. Turns out we only have to record the last few minutes of it due to a technical issue that we were able to recover from to some degree. But Darlene, what do you think about the state of the viewfinder these days, electronic versus optical?
Well, having come from the film world myself, I was hesitant to get into using the electronic ones. And I will admit the early ones were not so great. Having had the Fuji X-T1 now for over 3 years, and I've used several other different mirrorless cameras, I actually have really come to enjoy them. And I find that for a lot of beginners, especially those just starting with digital and they've never used film, so they don't know the difference, there's a lot of benefits for them. You know, the histogram, the white balance you could see on screen as you're shooting, whether you're underexposed, overexposed, those are all great learning tools to help somebody when they're just getting started.
Yeah, and the extra information, I think, is really useful. I would love if you could have a hybrid display where you have a transparent LCD screen and you can get all those wonderful overlays of information and histograms and what have you that map to a real-world optical image. Maybe that's just me fantasizing about what might be really cool. But you're never going to have that in a mirrorless design. So you have to just kind of give up on that and understand that the viewfinders are getting better and better. And I think the GX8 technically had a better type of technology for the viewfinder, and they've kind of scaled that back a little bit, but they made it flip up and down, which is kind of neat. There was some really fun bits and pieces that, you know what? It's good. It's good enough to be that second camera, the one that becomes my my travel companion, or it's recording behind the scenes 4K video because it can do that as well. So I don't know. I would love to have the kind of technology in that viewfinder that makes it so I can't even tell the difference. And it's coming. It's just a matter of
time. The only thing I wish my X100F had was the flip screen. It doesn't. It has a fixed screen. And something that I tell people in terms of when I'm doing workshops and classes and that is I get them to stop using the LCD for framing and composing their pictures and look through the eyepiece. Because when you see through the eyepiece, you're cutting off your peripheral vision and you really concentrate on the composition better.
Yeah, and I do that too with a lot of in the field compositional tricks. It's not just do you change the position of the camera left, right, but do you choose a different vantage point? Mm-hmm. Do you physically mm-hmm. move the camera, like not just wiggle the tripod legs a few inches to the left or the right, or change the orientation of the camera, but do you walk 10 seconds down the path to a different point of view of the same subject? And you're not going to really perceive that distance, especially if it's a larger scale landscape. It's all about changing what your foreground is going to be at that point. And you can't do that when you're just looking through or looking at the LCD screen on the back, because you're kind of trapped in that location. You're seeing everything around you. It's locking you into that spot. But if you forget everything around you, in some strange way, it's more freeing to just say, okay, well, do I want this or do I not? Do I need to scrap it or completely reinvent the scene?
So bottom line, we're saying there's advantages to both.
There is. And I think that it's all a tool.
Totally.
Right? It's all the tools that a photographer can use to make a better image. And you've got to be a good photographer to use a tool appropriately. And the more a tool can teach you to be a good photographer, the better.
Yes. And I'm a big believer on use the tool that is right for you, not what somebody else tells you to use.
Yes. Yes. I do a lot of my macro work without a tripod. And some people come into my studio, with a lot of background knowledge, and they swear up and down saying that it's impossible. You can't do that without, well, yeah, you can. And it's actually not that hard, especially when you're doing tabletop macro stuff where you can rest your wrists and your arms against the table functioning as a tripod and giving you a lot more freedom of motion than you would otherwise have if you were completely and truly locked down. So, yeah, I think we're on the same page there, Darlene, and I think it's time that we wrap up this wonderful conversation. What's coming up next for you? I know you're busy doing so many things, but what's going to keep you excited about the next coming months?
The next 6 months or so. I have a couple of workshops coming up. I do one in Southern Alberta a couple times a year. So I've got that is full, and I'm actually partnering with a new workshop leader. So I'm sort of training him to eventually take over that workshop so I can branch out and do more. So that's kind of exciting, expanding our team. We have a new tour leader, and we're sending him off to Morocco. He came with us last year, and Daniel and I will be doing India in November. So I'm super stoked. I've never been to India, and I'm really excited about that. So we're adding lots of new tour destinations, and super excited about
that. That'll be an adventure. You know, I'm kind of envious because, you know, all you landscape photographers go to these wonderful exotic locations or, you know, exotic from our perspective. But, you know, I toil away in my backyard. You know, I just yesterday bought a bunch of interesting minerals on eBay, which is always a dangerous thing. And I'm going to stage them with little insects to be like running through these crystal encrusted mines of things with creative lighting ideas that I've played out all in my head. And this will just be just on a table in my studio, you know, no far off, beautiful landscape, but magic to be made nonetheless.
Well, Daniel does some landscapes. I'm not super big on landscapes myself. I do them when they're there in front of me. I'm more of a people photographer, and I love people. And so I'm really excited about India and the sadhus and all the, you know, interesting characters that we're going to meet there. But I have an idea
colors.
For you. You could do the bugs of the world, macro photography, insects of the world.
I could. That would be
just saying.
Well, I mean, people have done that before, and when you're doing them in more of a documentary standpoint, it's not as interesting for me. It's just the telling whatever the narrative happens to be, and I can do that with. We've got these very cute and charismatic weevils that I think I mentioned earlier in the podcast that I used as an actor in one of my photographs, and they just hang about on like they're technically a pest, but I don't mind if there's a few of them around eating a few leaves because I can just grab that leaf and they are very cooperative. They'll just sit around, and you can just say, "Hey, you know what? Why don't you sit on this rock for, I don't know, 10 seconds and you'll get about that much time out of them, and that should be all you'd need." So, but I've got a bunch of workshops coming up as well, a full day macro workshop in my studio and in our award-winning gardens here. I do water droplet refraction workshops, which is a 3-hour intensive program. And at the end of it, you use water droplets as lenses. And it's a really fun project to get into, especially if you have no experience in this area, because you'd be surprised how much you can learn in one sort of session. It's like riding a bike. Once you figure it out, you can repeat the process, and it's almost like muscle memory. Then it's just a creative endeavor. How do you create a better and more interesting subject worth photographing? So lots of fun stuff there. And cool. Of course, Photo Geek Weekly continues to grow. The audience is bigger than I would have expected at this point. And so thank you all for listening. And you can find us at photogeekweekly.com. And if you follow me on social media, then you'll see all the postings of all the latest episodes. But Darlene, where can people find you? I think we might have mentioned it earlier that you live in a number of places.
I do.
In social media and your main website, where can people go?
So my main website is digitalphotomentor.com. And you can find me on Twitter as DP Mentor, as well as Instagram, same thing, and Facebook, Digital Photo Mentor as well.
All right. And all of those links are going to be in the show notes as well at photogeekweekly.com. Thank you for listening. And thanks for everybody that continues to support us. There's a little tip jar, and I continuously get a few dollars here and there that keep me well caffeinated and pay for the hosting of the podcast. We are on Patreon as well. And so if you want to commit to a continual donation of even a dollar or so, then it all adds up and it helps make this show more successful and lets me dedicate more time to growing this podcast and this network. I've got a lot of great ideas. Just got to find the time to make it all happen. So once again, thanks for listening, everybody. And I think it's time to get out and shoot.